Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
We're only back with Which Way LA. Carrie Kirschman lived for 21 years in L.A.'s quaint and classic Fairfax District, protected by rent control. Then she and her neighbors were evicted under the Ellis Act. That law allows landlords to get out of the rental business as long as they stay out for 5 years. But within weeks, Kirschman says her apartment was being advertised on Airbnb. Carrie Kirschman, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us how you found this out and what happened as a result.
How I found out that we were being advertised on the internet?
Yeah.
I looked on the internet.
That's all it took.
That's it.
So tell us a little bit more, if you will, about how long you lived in the neighborhood, what it meant to you, and what you were told when you were evicted.
I lived in the neighborhood for 21 years. I can't emphasize enough how much I loved the area that I lived in. It was close to everything, walking distance. It was a real community feeling. We knew our neighbors. We knew our postman. We knew, you know, everything that we wanted was right there at arm's length. I mean, between going to Fairfax to get a pastrami sandwich or getting produce or walking down to the post office, I thought that this neighborhood was my ideal.
What were you paying for rent?
By the time we moved out, below market value.
Below market value, and that was because of rent control.
Yes. When I moved in, I was paying above market value, but you stay someplace 21 years, it evens out.
Okay. So what did the landlord tell you when they told you you had to leave?
We never had a conversation with the landlord. They told us, the paperwork that we received said that they were withdrawing the apartment from the rental market.
And then you saw, once again, by looking on the internet, that it was being advertised by Airbnb.
Yes.
Let me introduce Randy Rennick. He's an attorney at Hadsdell Stormer & Rennick. His firm is representing Carrie Kirschman and others in a lawsuit. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Warren. Thanks very much.
What were you able to find out about the comparative amount of money that Carrie Kirschman had been paying and what the landlord was getting or had the capacity to get with Airbnb?
Well, the rent that Ms. Kirschman was paying was about $1,800 a month, roughly $50 or $60 a day. The landlord, just a few weeks after he wrongfully evicted her and the other plaintiffs from the apartments, was getting $400 or even $500 a night for each of the apartments on Airbnb.
So $1,800 for one as opposed to $400 or $500 for a bunch of them. What would that total up for a whole month?
Tens of thousands of dollars. He was getting them. 8 to 10 times the amount of rent from Airbnb as he was getting from Ms. Kirschman and the other plaintiffs.
Does it appear that the neighborhood is as attractive as Carrie Kirschman described it, and was he able to keep his apartments full?
Oh, certainly. It's a wonderful neighborhood. It's got charm, as many neighborhoods in Los Angeles do, with a lot of nice businesses nearby. My understanding is that he is at full capacity under Airbnb. But no longer with long-term clients or long-term tenants, of course. It's folks who are in for one night, two nights, tend to throw parties, be loud neighbors. There's been a number of complaints from the folks in the buildings next door about the goings-on. So it certainly has had a negative consequence, a negative impact on this neighborhood.
Let me introduce Jim Clark. He's Executive Vice President of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles. Jim Clark, good to have you on our program.
Good to be back for him. Thank you.
Do you know, is this a common thing that's happening here? Obviously, a lawsuit is pending, but is what we're hearing, does it sound to you like a violation of the Ellis Act?
Well, I can honestly say this. When I read this in the paper this morning, it's the first time I've heard of a situation, you know, like this. Our position is that we don't support short-term rentals in multifamily, only because a lot of the times it's the tenants that are renting out their own apartments, and we don't have control of the people coming in and out. With regard to the Ellis Act, you know, look, the Ellis Act is a big it's a tool that we use, and if it's used properly, it's been put in place so that people that are subject to rent control can go out of business. They have the right to go out of business if they want to go out. But if you have a rogue owner that uses it in a wrong manner, then I mean we can't condone that. I think that in this case, that the housing department in the city of Los Angeles and or the city attorney should have gotten involved here. Somebody may have dropped the ball. With that said, we don't support short-term rentals in multifamily buildings.
Let me go back to Carrie Kirschman. While you were living in the apartment in a building, were other tenants letting their places go for Airbnb?
There were four units in the building, and one of them, the last couple of years of our residency, was being used as an Airbnb. And it was an unpleasant situation to live through.
How so?
Well, I mean, if you have someone using a place as an Airbnb, first of all, they're not regulated as they would be in a hotel. You know, their behavior is anything from doing drugs to having loud parties to being completely disruptive. It was a very unpleasant thing to have to live through as your neighbor. I mean, quite often we had to contact the guest department to relight our units because there was so much disruption that the earthquake gas prevention valve went off because of the vibration from that one unit. I mean, these people were strangers with no regard to us or the community.
So, Jim Clark, back to you with the Apartment House Association. You're suggesting, I take it, the same kind of concern we just heard from Carrie Kirschman.
Carrie validates what our position is. The reason we oppose short-term rentals is because we would have no control over the people who are using already rented apartments on a short-term basis. We can't do any screening. We can't vet the people that are coming in. It's always done by Airbnb and the people that are renting the apartment.
So let me go back to Randy Rennick, the attorney who's representing Carrie Kirschman. How many people are involved in this lawsuit?
At this point, we have five plaintiffs, everyone who was evicted from this apartment building. There's an interesting aspect to the Ellis Act, which requires that if the unit is re-rented within 5 years, first it needs to go back to the original tenant. And if it doesn't go back to the original tenant, the maximum rent that can be collected, in this case by Airbnb, is the same rent that was being charged to the tenant who was displaced. So this is the $57 that I referred to earlier. That's the only amount that Airbnb can charge tenants now. Instead, they're charging $400 or $500. Certainly those folks would have standing to claim that overcharge by Airbnb and the landlord.
Well, who are you suing? Are you suing Airbnb or are you suing the owner of the building?
Both. The Airbnb as the company, the entity that markets the unit, that collects the rent on the unit, that does the transaction, that communicates with the short-term renters, is just the same as the landlord. And both of them, Airbnb and the landlord, had an obligation under the law to re-rent this unit back to Carrie, and they refused to do that. So both are liable under the Ellis Act and the City of Los Angeles's rent stabilization ordinance.
We don't have a representative of the landlord or Airbnb on our program. Let me just ask you, what are you hearing from them?
Not a thing. It appears that they have crawled under a rock.
Apparently, they wouldn't talk to the Los Angeles Times, which is where we heard about this story. Jim Clark, back to you. Have you heard of other similar situations involving Airbnb where a landlord did what was done and Airbnb then allowed the units to be rented?
Not under the guise of the Ellis Act. We've heard of, you know, maybe single units that become vacant and the owner might use it for a little while. But, this is a very interesting case. I really wish that the housing department and or the city attorney had been monitoring this use of Ellis instead of having tenants suing landlords, which we just, we do not like at all.
Carrie Kirschman, did you get in touch with the city, try anything from the city attorney or apply to one of the departments?
To the city attorney, no. I mean, the first thing that we did was we went over to the Coalition of Economic Survival, with the paperwork that we had originally received and asked, you know, questions about it and got advice. And the advice was that the initial round of paperwork was illegitimate. It wasn't filed through the city. And so we brought this to the attention of the city, and the city did contact our landlords. And days later, the landlords filed the correct paperwork. And I remember talking to the person at the Coalition for Economic Survival, who said to me the reason that he gave us illegitimate paperwork initially was because he wouldn't want to sign the real paperwork, because signing the real paperwork, and if he didn't take those units off the rental market, would be committing perjury.
So, Randy Rennick, back to you. Should the city have gotten involved sooner, made it unnecessary, perhaps, for you to file the suit?
It's possible, but I just want to point out that the Ellis Act evictions and filings are public records. They're accessible by anyone, myself or Airbnb. So if Airbnb didn't know, they certainly could have known with just a few minutes of work, checking into the city to determine this was, in fact, an Ellis Act eviction, and it could not be put back on the market.
Have you heard of other situations like this?
I have. I've heard of quite a few now. It appears that it's a real problem in Hollywood with the new developments, that folks are being paid for their keys, essentially. Sometimes it goes to an Ellis Act eviction, and then the landlord develops that or immediately flips it back onto the short-term rental market.
What's supposed to happen when there is a change of this kind? To tell us, what are tenants supposed to get if, in fact, they are evicted because there's going to be a change in the way the property is being handled?
Well, there's two protections in the Ellis Act, in the city's ordinance. And the first is that if they're evicted against their will, they have to be paid a relocation fee. Perhaps just importantly, if or when that unit comes back on the market in the next 5 years, that unit has to be offered back to the original tenant. And so there's two very important pieces to protect the tenant so they can't be tossed out just so the landlord can put it onto the short-term rental market.
Kerry Kirschman, would you move back if you could?
Yes. I mean, this is a place that was my home, that I was very happy in. In my fantasy, I've never left. Mm-hmm. Of course, dealing with our landlord would be a difficult thing to do.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. We'll see what happens. Kerry Kirschman, the tenant evicted from her apartment in the Fairfax District. Randy Rennick, her attorney with Hadstall, Stormer & Rennick. Jim Clark, Executive Vice President of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles. Thanks to you all.
Thank you,
Warren.
In a moment, San Diego takes the lead against global warming on Which Way L.A.?
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app, available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. San Diego's Republican Mayor Kevin Faulkner calls it the right thing to do. He persuaded conservative businesses it was in their interests. The city council, controlled by Democrats, approved it unanimously. So San Diego is now the largest American city to establish mandatory deadlines for reduction of greenhouse emissions. That means 100% renewable energy generation by 2035, enforceable by law. Joshua Smith is environmental reporter for the San Diego Union Tribune. Joshua, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Much is being made of the contrast with the climate change summit in Paris, where they only had voluntary deadlines for emission reductions. What happened in San Diego?
Right. Well, obviously, San Diego is a little bit different than a meeting of world leaders where you're trying to get people from different countries to agree. San Diego had a confluence of different forces kind of moving on it all at the same time, where they decided at the last minute to do something that was pretty aggressive.
Very aggressive, it would seem to me, the first city in the country to do anything like this. In addition to the deadline, is it going to have to be all solar and wind by 2035, or can you have nuclear generation as well? What's required?
All renewable sources, yeah. Basically, you have you can buy credits. So, I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily all be generated locally, but the power would have to come from all renewable sources.
Then there are other rules. Cut vehicle trips in designated transit areas 20% within the next 5 years, 50% within 10 years. That's a big deal, too.
Right, exactly. So the majority of the cuts come from the 100% renewable energy goal. That's 60% of all local strategies. But then probably the next biggest strategy is getting people out of their cars within key transit areas. So everyone that lives within a half mile of transit priority areas, about half of those people will be needed to get out of their cars and either start walking, biking, or taking public transportation.
Okay, and the city itself is going to have zero-emission vehicles in its fleet.
Right, yeah, yep, they're going to ratchet that up as well.
So this is a big deal. How did it happen? You said there was a confluence of forces. Was it just a lot of people who decided, as the mayor said, this is the right thing to do?
I think what happened is San Diego was just in the kind of the right place at the right time. They had been pushing, folks inside of City Hall had been pushing for an enforceable climate action plan as far back as 2010. Suddenly it seemed like there was traction for it. And then the county of San Diego was hauled into court for having a climate action plan that wasn't aggressive enough. And when leaders at City Hall saw that, they took notice. And then the voices of the environmental community, I think, got particular traction once they saw the legal action that was being taken against the county.
Let me introduce Nicole Kaperitz, executive director of the Climate Action Campaign in San Diego. Good to have you on our show.
Thank you.
So how important was the loss of the lawsuit, do you think, by the county?
Yeah, I think that was an instrumental component in convincing the elected officials to move forward with an enforceable plan. But I also want to give credit to our decision makers because, from my perspective, they decided it was the right thing to do from a public policy perspective. I mean, we're experiencing, right, unprecedented drought. We've had heat waves, hot, you know, highest temperatures on world record. We're on the coast, so people know exactly what erosion and sea level rise is going to mean. So I think there's an element of wanting to protect the people and places we love that also drove the decision.
So what does this mean, then, if, in fact, the city can't meet these deadlines, can't have all of its electricity generated by renewables by 2035? That's not very far away. Would you be willing to sue?
Well, everything's on the table all the time. We have to use every tool in the toolbox. It's not something we want to do. We are committed to working in partnership with the city and other stakeholders to make sure we stay on task and we identify the right approaches and solutions. But at the end of the day, again, it goes beyond any legal mandate. It goes to the idea of making sure that we're protecting quality of life for future generations.
Joshua Smith, back to you with the Union Tribune. Where does the law come from? Is this generated by Sacramento?
Yeah, well, this is part of the executive orders issued by Governor Schwarzenegger and then Governor Brown saying that we have to cut emissions by 40 and then 80% below 1990 levels. And then there was an evolution saying that CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, needed to also address this, and there was some changes that happened there. And then I believe the legal analysis of this stretches back even to 2005 when there was a case up in Southern California where a general plan update was dinged for not mitigating for those greenhouse gas reductions. So when that happened, that kind of set the backdrop for this whole thing. And then when you saw the case in the county of San Diego, that just further established the fact that Sacramento is kind of having this ratcheting up of pressure on municipalities to start cutting these emissions. I don't think anything's necessarily quite set in stone yet. I mean, we're all just figuring this out as it moves along.
Nicole Kaperitz, back to you with the Climate Action Campaign. How well prepared is San Diego to meet these deadlines, which are coming up pretty soon?
That's a great question. I think we're not sure yet. I mean, obviously, as outside community-based organizations, we've been, you know, really clear with the city that we do expect them to have a really detailed implementation plan and stay on point and meet deadlines. But at the end of the day, it's about commitment to resources, right? It's about ensuring this is still one of their top priorities. And I think that's always going to require watchdogging to make sure that happens.
So, Joshua Smith, are other cities going to have to do the same thing?
I think that that's a political question. I mean, it depends on what the pressure is like from the environmental nonprofits in major cities. I think L.A. could likely see a lot of pressure considering the fallout, but considering the achievement that San Diego has recently undertaken, I think L.A. could see a lot of pressure politically from the environmental nonprofits and maybe even from elected officials up in Sacramento.
Let me introduce Matt Peterson. He is the Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Los Angeles. He's the first person ever to hold that job, created by Mayor Eric Garcetti. Matt Peterson, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Warren.
What about L.A.?
Well, in April, Mayor Garcetti released our first ever sustainable city plan, and encompassed within the sustainable city plan was a climate action plan. We set the target of 80% reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 over 1990. Just before the mayor went to Paris, we released our climate action report showing we'd reduced emissions by 20% since 1990 as of 2013, using a new, more vigorous tougher inventory standard that we use to revise our baseline standard. We've set targets to reduce emissions by 45% by 2025, made possible by getting our utility off of coal, getting to 900 megawatts of solar locally, and we're moving our fleet to electric vehicles. We'll have the largest purely battery electric fleet of any city in America by the end of next June, with 164 battery electrics cars joining our fleet.
Well, now, San Diego, by the year 2035, is supposed to be operating 100% with electric generation from renewables. Can L.A. do that?
You know, we're on the path to get off of coal by 2025. We're on the path to get to 50% renewable energy by 2030. To hit our 2050 target of 80% greenhouse gas emission reductions, it's going to have to include further energy efficiency investments, further renewable energy, further reduction in transportation emissions. We've set targets to reduce the amount of car trips per capita in the city. We're putting in 1,000 electric vehicle charging stations throughout the city by 2017 to help people move into EVs when they do drive, and, of course, investing $40 billion in our mass transit system across the county.
Okay, you said 80% generation of energy by renewables by 2050. San Diego's got 100% by 2035.
We're reducing emissions by 80% by 2050.
Reduce emissions. Okay,
yeah,
what
so
about the generation?
All the sources. So,
can you give me a comparison to San Diego generating 100% by 2035?
Well, San Diego Gas and Electric, which provides electricity to the city of San Diego and their residents, currently has no coal in their mix. So I think if you looked at the move we're making for the city of LA and our utility from having nearly 40% coal-fired power emissions now in our system to zero by 2025 and then moving to 50% renewables, it's quite a swing, and we hope to continue to go further beyond 2030, past that mark.
So let me go back to Nicole Lekapritz with the Climate Action Campaign in San Diego. Has San Diego become a model that Los Angeles and others are going to be asked to meet?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I was waiting for Matt to talk about the opportunity to get to 100%. I didn't quite hear that. But, you know, I think it's also critical to understand that the pathway to success for 100% clean energy in San Diego is for us to actually break away from San Diego Gas and Electric and to control our purchasing decisions over electricity in-house. So I think that's going to be taking advantage of an innovative state program that's available to local cities. But yeah, at the end of the day, we really want all of California to be powered by 100% clean energy, and we'd love to export our success into other cities nationwide as well.
So, Matt Peterson, you mentioned that San Diego Gas and Electric doesn't have any coal. Obviously, Los Angeles is a lot bigger, a lot more complex than San Diego. But is this going to be a model that will embarrass Los Angeles or require it to move faster than it might have otherwise?
Well, we're hardly embarrassed. We tip our hats to San Diego and look forward to working with them to help work together as mayors across the country, as Mayor Garcetti's engaged with mayors and our Mayor's National Climate Action Agenda, to figure out how we work through these obstacles as well as turn them into opportunities, how we report our emissions, how we work together to increase the EVs in our fleet. We again tip our hats and look forward to working together. Hopefully Mayor Falconer will join our Mayor's National Climate Action Agenda now that the Climate Action Plan has been released, and we're happy to share our experiences with getting off of coal and moving more aggressively into renewable energy and in our 900 megawatts of solar we hope to have in the city of L.A. by 2025.
Joshua Smith, back to you with the San Diego Union-Tribune. You talked about the kind of pressure that's going to be raised in Sacramento and elsewhere. On the other hand, there's a lot of pressure in the other direction, too, it seems to me, when you're talking about getting people out of their cars, making them ride bikes, or find other means of getting transportation and so on. What about a possible backlash?
Well, I think it's important to understand that really the bottom line is cutting emissions. So if LA wants to get to an 80% reduction below 1990 levels by 2050 by getting people out of their cars or doing other things, they don't necessarily have to go 100% renewable energy to do that. They can decide whatever mix they want to do to try to meet the reduction benchmarks. But San Diego, they just decided to go 100% renewable to slice out a big chunk of that because they felt like that was something that they could actually control. They could really control that. It's a lot harder to try to get people out of their cars in Southern California than to, say, form a community choice aggregation program that could take those the choice of where to get energy away from the utility, which is something that San Diego is looking at.
So, Nicole Kappas, there is then a considerable flexibility in what is required.
Actually, in the city of San Diego's plan, there's opportunity to tweak it here and there, but we have a really detailed roadmap, and each strategy within our roadmap is binding. So there's some flexibility, but not really.
Matt Peterson, in L.A., is everything binding? Is it legally enforceable?
Well, it was released through an executive directive from the mayor to the general managers of each of his departments, and they were ordered to implement it. And we're working together with the departmental chief sustainability officers that each general manager is appointed to make sure they succeed. And the mayor holds them accountable through their annual GM reviews and through the budget process, where they have to show how their budget proposals move the needle on our targets in the plan. And one of the things I think that is great about what San Diego's doing and what we're doing, you know, whether you're going a prescriptive measure as San Diego has or our performance-based measure that also includes lots of specific targets on moving towards renewables and local solar and energy efficiency, is in that mix, there's an opportunity to figure out how we get the storage we need into the system to make this kind of aggressive move, even at 50% renewable energy, which is nobody thought was possible 5-10 years ago in the state of California. We're going to need a significant amount of battery storage. How do we put that into our neighborhoods, into our homes, into our grid scale? That's what's going to be critical, and that's where perhaps what San Diego is doing can help move the needle, is looking at how do we more aggressively get into the battery storage question and figure that out together.
All right, Matt Peterson, once again, the first Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Los Angeles. Thanks to you. Thanks to Nicole Kappas with the Climate Action Campaign in San Diego, and Joshua Smith with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Great to have you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, good to be here.
Remember, too, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page.